A legacy title steps out of its comfort zone with a standalone spin-off focused on food, and we explore the pleasures and sorrows of covering technology in print, plus a new style and culture journal from Nottingham. All that ahead of us today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, with me, Tom Edwards. With articles running the gamut of the human and natural sciences, National Geographic is a magazine with an unusually broad scope. But one topic it's not necessarily famous for covering is food, but all that might be about to change. On November 30th, National Geographic launched a new monthly magazine dedicated to gastronomy. It's the second UK spin-off from the main magazine since the launch of Traveller back in 2010. To find out more, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the new title's editorial director, Maria Pieri.
Maria, welcome to Monocle 24. And very exciting news. I have the new issue of National Geographic Food UK. And I have to say, I mean, for the first cover, it's just amazing. It's chocolate. I mean, who doesn't like chocolate as well? Tell us about the process of launching this issue. It's amazing that National Geographic, you know, is launching print title. I know the market can be a bit hard sometimes, but there are space for beautiful magazines like this.
Yes, there is space, we think, for another food title. We are looking at introducing something slightly different to the market. So when you get a chance to flick through, you'll see we haven't really gone down the route of looking at just creating recipes piece after piece. What we're looking to do is creating a magazine which is very much a thinking person's magazine that gives you an opportunity to have that recipe-driven focus, but also have the stories behind the food and the people that are involved in creating it.
And it's amazing. And again, continue the National Geographic tradition is very international as well. So I was just flicking through very quickly. There are stories from Greece, from Sweden. I guess that's the intention of the brand, right?
Yes, we will have that global appeal in terms of the food and travel aspect, which we think there is an audience for. And of course, carrying on that tradition of National Geographic, amazing photography to go with that. So of course, we do have a feature actually from Cyprus. It's Cyprus driven, where we have, it was called our Breaking Bread piece, where we go and dine with a family who are going to then tell us all about their traditions and tell us about the food they cooked. But they're actually in the UK, so there's also the domestic appeal. And then we'll take that breaking bread idea and we're going to take that globally as well. And next we'll be looking at going into a home with somebody from Croatia.
Will it be kind of a monthly magazine? What's kind of the business details, like circulation?
Yes, frequency, kind of... we're hoping to do it monthly. We're doing our two test issues now, as I'm sure most people will have an idea of what it's like to launch a new magazine. It's been tough. So we're starting off with two issues that we think will be amazing, and then we're going to go straight fill in to a monthly frequency. So next issue will be actually, it will actually be the February issue. So we're going to skip January, which is why we've done a big focus on chocolate. So that'll cover us. And
yeah,
then after that,
always.
Yeah, chocolate covers us. Chocolate covers everyone.
What about the food brand of National Geographic? Is it, I know it's launching here in the UK, but did they had other food issues around the world? You know that?
No, this is the first. It's the first of a new brand in print. Mm-hmm. Online, they obviously do cover stories about food and they look at it globally, of course, you know, anything from food wastage to what types of food and ugly food. They had quite a funny kind of column about ugly food in terms of wonky veg. So, yeah, they've got that side of it. But they've also got the more serious angle, which you'd expect. And we will feature that within the magazine. Our hope is to create a balanced magazine which has great storytelling and bringing that National Geographic ethos to the market with fantastic storytelling, but also the domestic appeal. So as you, Fernando just flicked through to our roast feature, which is obviously looking at a great British institution, the actual roast. So we hope to bring a little bit of everything to the market.
I love a good roast. And again, tell us a bit about your career before you launched this magazine. You were already at National Geographic, but were you working at their Traveller magazine as well?
Yes, that's right. I'm the editorial director for National Geographic Traveller. So we have great experience with working with them now. It's been about... I think it's coming up to seven and a half years now that we've been working on that title. And what we did notice is that there is an increasing trend for food and travel. So there is a gastronomy angle there that we've also featured that within the magazine. You'd expect us to have some travel within a National Geographic magazine. And of course, that is featured through that. In this issue, we've got Sweden.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but every time I go to a new stand, of course, we have National Geographic Traveler, National Geographic Magazine, now the food one. But you also have a lot of kind of special issues. I mean, more and more I've been noticing. Is this a good market as well to explore, do you think?
Yes, I think, as with any publisher, they're looking to see what works on the market. And for them, the specials do work. If they focus on one subject, so they've had food specials before, for example, they did a superfood special and they do different specials. But they've got a new history magazine, for example, that's working very well in the States. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that coming into the UK. So their one-off series do particularly well as well. Often just creating magazines from content they already have pre-existing, but also creating new content too for a different audience. We've seen with the superfood special they did that sold very well. We're hoping we can obviously ride off the back of that and any other thing that they do, which is fantastic.
I always ask all the editors that come in, which kind of other publications do they admire, you know, or they look for inspiration, or just for, you know, for a weekend read, you know?
For a weekend read. I still pick up quite a lot of the freemium papers. So I really like Balance. Mm-hmm. The magazine, I think that's a fantastic magazine that has a good balance for me, food and also kind of like the lifestyle element too. Separately, I also read Red Online. So I used to subscribe. I don't subscribe now, but I do read Red Online. And then in my own job, obviously, I read all the food magazines now and all the travel magazines. So there's a lot out there and there's a lot to digest. And obviously, when you're launching a new title, you do look at what everybody else is doing and see what is it that you offer that's the USP. So for us, we had to really carefully think, is there somewhere for us to sit? Does it make sense for us to launch a food title? And I think the feedback from people, though obviously there are people that want to be nice to us at the moment, feedback has been terrific because we have hopefully introduced a magazine that is about food, but it's sort of like a thinking person's food magazine as well. It tells great stories, and that's what National Geographic's known for. So we want to tell the stories behind what's going on in the food industry and the food market.
And again, very clear design. For example, I just stopped, there's an interesting cute article, Wish You Know Earlier, like Kitchen Hacks. But I just love the design, very clear, you know, straight to the point. Because sometimes, you know, some magazines, as lovely as they are, but they can be, you know,
Quite busy.
And yeah, it makes me a bit stressed.
Yeah, that's the one thing that we think, particularly with Traveller as well, with our Traveller magazine. We do seem to be one of the, well, if I can say only magazines, we are a magazine that specialises in giving people something to read. And I think one of the reasons I perhaps don't subscribe to lots and lots of magazines is that often it might take me an hour to read them from, you know, cover to cover. And that's, for me, not what we want to do. We want to create a magazine that people want to dip in, read, come back to time and time again. And that is reflected in the design. If you look at the sort of longer pieces that we have in there, they do have a story. And that's something that we want to bring to the fore when we're doing National Geographic Food. There's a story behind the food. If it's farm to fork, if it's sustainability, or if it's just about your favourite recipe that, you know, you've created, or how food might actually make you feel and how your relationship with food might differ. So,
and finally, Maria, one thing I noticed as well, it's a very confident launch as well. It looks like an established magazine already. 162 pages as well. That's a good number.
Yeah, so it's a lot of pages. Yeah. The first issue, we did a Christmas special. We launching in a December issue was tough because we introduced a December a kind of focus also on the Christmas side of stuff. We had to. I think we couldn't ignore Christmas. In future, it'll be 148 pages, which is slightly more manageable for us. But yes, it is a confident launch. We're experienced at working with lots of content. We know how to manage it, and we think that people will want something that they can read and dip into. And so we hope we've created that.
Well done. Congratulations. Thank you so much
for
coming.
That was Maria Pieri, editorial director of National Geographic Food magazine. And issue one is out now. There are conspicuously few indie print titles addressing perhaps the most essential and ubiquitous phenomenon of the century so far, technology and our relationship to it. Logic is a triennial magazine that trains a critical eye on technology with a different theme each issue. The first two covered respectively intelligence and sex, while the latest deals with the weighty topic of justice. To find out more, Monocle's producer Henry Rees-Sheridan spoke to two of the magazine's founders, Moira Weigel and Jim Fingal.
In your manifesto, you've written that most tech writing is shallow and pointless. I want to know why you think that, maybe beginning with you, Moira.
You know, I think in the manifesto, as in any manifesto, we were trying to be a bit provocative and cheeky. So, of course, it's not that we think we're the first good tech writers ever to come along. But I do think the group of us who founded the magazine felt that there was not a home for a kind of tech writing that we were interested in seeing. And we felt, in particular, that there was a big gap between what we call the sycophants and the scolds. So sort of the tech crunch kind of business reporting, very enthusiastic, sometimes feels like a press release Xeroxed into an article type coverage that we saw a lot. And then the sort of longer, often more critical or skeptical coverage we saw either in academic publications or in places we love, like the New York Review of Books or the New Yorker, that felt, or, you know, we would always invoke Jonathan Franzen as sort of the epitome of the scold. And we felt that there was sort of a wide open space between these two extremes for thoughtful writing about how technology is changing not just economic life, but really every aspect of life. You know, it's not just a business story, it's an everything story. We also wanted, I think, to be closer to technologists than a lot of the writing we read felt. So I think, you know, the media industry in the United States is primarily based in New York. All of us involved have some kind of arts or literary background and often had, at least in my case and Ben Tarnoff's case, had strong connections to New York. But we felt that because the American literary scene, or a lot of it, was so centered there, that there was kind of a missed opportunity to talk to folks more closely connected to the machine, as our friend Ellen Ullman would say, or, you know, to the tech industry more broadly. So that was sort of what we meant by that quip.
So, Jim, picking up on that topic of proximity, you also identify, I think, in the manifesto as both insiders and outsiders in relation to technology. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, well, even literally, I mean, I've worked in the tech industry for about 10 years. I'm currently the head of engineering for a healthcare transparency startup. A number of other people who are either work on the magazine or were founders or engineers or otherwise worked in tech companies. So there's, I think, a particular perspective that comes from that. You know, I think Moira mentioned Ellen Ullman. I mean, there's a particular spark, I think, of recognition when you read something that was, you read Ellen write about what it's like to create software, or, for example, like Anna Wiener write about what it's like to be in a tech company in Silicon Valley. And it's kind of like shocking for how rare that is. So we thought that bringing a perspective that is grounded in actually working for these companies and building software and building technology would provide an important viewpoint. And also from the outsider point of view, I mean, many of us come from, I think actually all of us come from liberal arts backgrounds, or are academics, or academics who have also done some coding, or journalists who have done some technical writing. So we feel like we can bring both the perspective of working in technology to a literary publication, and also the classical humanities concerns into thinking about technology.
Moira, earlier you mentioned that there is perhaps, with some types of digital or technological reporting, a bias towards digital native platforms. Mm-hmm. Now, on the Stack, we featured two separate independent magazines dedicated exclusively to dogs, but none so far about tech. Why is that? Is there a bias against producing nice magazines in the tech sector? And also, are there particular challenges posed by tech coverage when it comes to reproducing it in print form?
It's a really great question. That's quite funny about the dogs and the tech. I mean, of course, there's something that seems almost quixotic about making a print publication in 2017. I mean, above all, in Silicon Valley. I think that, so it makes sense that folks who spend all their time thinking about digital networks and digital devices might not necessarily have that as sort of their first instinct or impulse. We wanted to make a print product for various reasons, some of them practical, which Jim perhaps is better to speak to than I am. But I think that we felt that the cadence of a print magazine, you know, we come out 3 times a year, not every 2 hours or something, the way the digital news cycle works. And we really take pride in Logic as an object that you can touch. It has great hand feel that you can live with. We like to use it as an occasion to throw events and host panels and sort of bring people together in physical space. And so I think for both practical economic reasons that Jim could speak to about, you know, making it sustainable, but also because of the kind of reading and the kind of convening of different thinkers and makers and folks that a physical object makes possible, we very much wanted to have a print product from the beginning, even though there is something admittedly kind of counterintuitive or even like romantic about it.
So, Jim, tell me about the economic opportunities presented by print. And also tell me a little bit about the opportunities for opening up particular ways of writing or thinking about tech, which are either precluded or facilitated by print. Because one thing that I've noticed is that a lot of tech writing on the web, like a lot of writing about any topic on the web, relies very heavily on graphics, graph, but also, perhaps most fundamentally, linking to other writing and sources on the internet. It's a way which is very useful for example, linking directly to a website that you're talking about. You can't do that in print, but what opportunities are opened up?
Yeah, I think I can answer, you know, a few parts of that question. I mean, there's like a very basic concern where print is actually a relatively tried and true technology for producing an object that you can sell to people and have them give you money in exchange for it. Whereas for a lot of other digital writing or journalism, we're still kind of figuring that out. There is a close relationship and one that I think we kind of chose and embraced to have this, you know, physical book that comes out a few times a year writing about technology. I mean, it means that we're not writing about breaking news or any particular product releases, but we're trying to have this more long form, intimate, thoughtful conversation that you could have with a reader away from any sort of screens. That's like shareable in a different sort of way of handing it off to someone rather than sending them tweeting about it or sending a link.
I wanted to just sing the praises of Jim as our in-house fact checker as well and a great fact-checking expert. I think that hyperlinking on the one hand does create these opportunities for cognitive surplus, you know, for discovering new things and leaping around. I love to read that way on the internet. On the other hand, it's increasingly easy to find a link to in support of like almost any claim in the era of fake news, filter bubbles, etc. And so I think that there is also a certain rigor to print long form and having to explain and justify things without relying directly or overly on links, not to be technophobic or anything. I use links all the time and can learn a lot from them, but there are advantages of another kind, I think, too long form, and Jim is always the stickler we're very grateful for in the fact-checking process, making sure that whatever claim has been put in really does hold up.
So I think you guys, I've kind of rudely guesstimated at your ages and the kind of average age of the editorial team, and I guess that you guys probably more or less grew up on the internet. But I wonder, are there any print magazines that influenced you when it came to thinking about how you wanted Logic to look and feel and maybe be structured?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the just like physical look and feel, I mean, we were inspired a bit by Animal Shelter, which is semi-text magazine. We really liked the size of the book, the amount of breathing space the text had in terms of both the margins, the font size, the line height. We were also inspired by books in general, but the Song Cave books, which is a series of poetry books. I in particular liked the matte covers of those. And we reached out to them and actually found our printer through connecting with them and a few other independent printers. I think in terms of content, I mean, Maura can speak more to this, but I think we're come out of the tradition of small magazines. So things like New Inquiry, LA Review of Books, Jacobin, writing what I think are particularly thoughtful and maybe, I don't know if it's a bad word, but intellectual pieces about things that engage with our daily lives. I think we found a bit of inspiration there.
Yeah, I think Jim said it. I think that, you know, the upshot of the collapse of both academia and the print industry has meant this flowering of little magazines in the United States anyway, it feels like. And we grew up in the sense that we were sort of finishing up college around the time that M Plus One launched and the New Inquiry launched and Jacobin, I think. I'm trying to remember the exact dates for Jacobin. But I think that each of these magazines has had a really profound effect on the conversation. I mean, particularly Jacobin on political conversation right now, but also M Plus One on literary and intellectual conversation. So I think we were really inspired by these ambitious little magazines to want to do something similar for the world that we were living in, which was this world more proximate to technology.
There's also a little bit of a pleasant irony with the fact that actually the Logic Fulfillment headquarters, where we store all the books and ship them out from, is literally the garage of my apartment. So as a tech magazine in print, we are the quintessential startup operating out of a garage. Yeah, and it's interesting now that I think about the connection with the garage startup is that actually we've brought some of the project management discipline that we've experienced developing software in a mode called Agile, which is basically revolves around the idea that you never quite know what you want the finished product to be. So work in short feedback loops, try to create a backlog of the most important things that you're working on, estimate them, work through them, have regular retrospectives about what went well and what went wrong in any particular, you know, week or magazine or, you know, Kickstarter campaign. It's one very positive thing a lot of us who have worked in technology have come away with is this, like, extremely thoughtful, civilized way of producing a product. And, you know, I don't know of other print publications that bring that to bear when reading it.
That was Moira Weigel and Jim Fingal from Logic Magazine and Issue 3. Justice is on Good Newsstands now. Finally on today's programme, Maudy, a new magazine from Nottingham that showcases and explores the work of creative talents from a diverse range of fields all in one place. Here's the magazine's head of editorial and its creative director, Stuart Brown, in conversation with Fernando about the thinking behind the title.
Well, I kind of saw a lot of magazines recently that are going to Ideas on Paper in Nottingham quite a bit. I've been kind of researching the market for quite a while, and I wanted to create something that was a little bit different. It felt more like a book than a magazine. So you pick it up and it's, because it's A5, you can kind of transport it a lot better. Stick it in your bag when you go on a plane, or it's just more usable. I wanted to kind of put everything under one roof.
And you also did some sort of partnership with GF Smith, right? The paper company.
Yeah, that was really cool. I went to the printing press originally and they were saying, oh, we can do this and we can do that. And I was like, it's not really what I'm after. And then when I was walking out, there were all these lovely looking magazines on a shelf and I was like, how do you do that? And they were like, oh, GF Smith, we use for sponsorship for like students and stuff. So I got in touch and then they were like, yeah, I'd love to sponsor it. So
before we talk a bit about the magazine itself, you're from Nottingham and you're based there. How is the magazine scene there? It's a city that, I have to be honest, I don't know much about it.
Yeah, it's growing, I'd say. Mm. I'd say there's it's nice to see people kind of putting the phones down and picking up publications and stuff like that and having a read. Nottingham, it's always seemed a bit behind the times with things, like whereas you come to London and everything's like now. Nottingham, we seem to get it a few years after. So it's like music I think they're probably still listening to dubstep in Nottingham or something. So, yeah, it's up and coming. It's a great place. They've got the creative quarter that they do loads of events and stuff like that. So,
Tell us about the title. I'm very curious. Maudie.
Maudie, basically, I wanted to create a word. Originally, I was going to call it Nunchy, but I thought with Maudie, it creates its own explanation. So say you go on Google and you search for Maudie, the only thing that's going to come up is Maudie.
That's
so
good.
It just makes it more searchable for people and more easier to find, basically.
Because I hate it, because there are cases where, you know, you like a brand or something, but they are called, I don't know, Love, let's say, something very simple, but it's so hard to find.
Yeah, definitely. And when I was researching the name, I noticed a lot of that and thought, I want something that can be itself rather than people searching for it and not being able to find it. It's just easy to find, I guess.
It's a good mix of topics as well. It's about fashion, interiors, music as well.
Yeah.
Was that the idea to do like a little, I don't know, cultural fashion design kind of title?
Yeah, I wanted it to be like a collaboration of art, really, rather than it just being design. Because it's very design-based. Like, if you look at it, there's a lot of good design gone into it. But I wanted to kind of put everything under one roof so you can look into the way people's minds work and stuff. So say you look at the Chloe Martini article, you kind of look into her production and the way she does her thing, like the way she produces her music. And then it's the same with the design and the architecture. And yeah, just wanted to kind of look into the way it is more rather than...
One thing that I was impressed is that, you know, it's your first issue, and I usually ask the editors about their business plan, and I can see there's, you know, quite a few already advertisers there. So what was the plan? You know, okay, you had the idea for your magazine, so did you pitch to some advertisers? What was the process like?
At first, I kind of threw myself in at the deep end, really. Mm-hmm. I was a bit like, oh God, what am I doing? I contacted the people that I wanted to feature. They said yes or no, and that was like basically it, pretty much. Originally they said there were a few places that weren't interested until it kind of got to a higher level than what it was at, so like issue 4 or issue 5 or but I think the ones we featured, they're very aesthetically pleasing and yeah, nice content, I think.
And you know, I have to one usually I'm not impressed, but there's a nice part of recipes here, and pumpkin chai's movie, it does look
delicious.
Have you tried?
Yeah. It had to be done, really. Like once, because Alexandra, who did all the recipes, she kind of sent me everything through, and I was like, right, I'm going to have to try these things to make sure they work.
I'll try it at home.
I've got to say, delicious. Really good job of them. So.
And it's perfect for the Christmas season, I have to say as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of got that autumn, Christmassy feel about it. So, yes.
That was Stuart Brown in conversation with Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and issue 1 of Maudie is out now. That's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our production team of Fernando and Henry Rhys-Sheridan, and to our editors, of course, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. If you have any comments or queries, do drop a note to Fernando. You'll find him on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next weekend. You can always catch up and find out more at the website monocle.com or via your preferred podcast platform. If you're in London, you can also check out some of the magazines we've mentioned at Kiosk Cafe. It's a stone throw from here in Marylebone by Paddington Station in London. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.